Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It's Friday, April 22nd, 2022. Today, as we do each week, we check in with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, joins me with his reporting and editorial analysis. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
A milestone issue this week for Publishers Weekly, Andrew. The magazine's 150th anniversary is this year, and a commemorative issue is out this week, and it is 272 pages. That's about as big as a phone book, if anybody remembers what those look like.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it is really a remarkable issue for what has been a remarkable period in publishing history and for Publishers Weekly, an institution that's been covering the business since 1872. And, you know, I just want to say up front that we're gratified by the support from the publishing community who really stepped up to get behind this issue. Much of the issue is online for free. You can check it out on the PW website. The digital edition of the magazine is also available too, if you can't get a copy of the formidable print magazine. And I also want to call out the work of my colleagues here in putting this massive issue together, including my friend and former PW co-editorial chief, Michael Coffey, who oversaw the issue. Michael retired in 2014. To focus on his own work. Our listeners may know that he's a formidable scholar and student of Samuel Beckett, but we were lucky to draw him back to oversee this one.
150 years of books and publishing is a lot to cover. So how does this issue get all of it in?
Well, there's a lot of history here for sure, but this issue really sort of focuses on the last 25 years, or a lot of it does anyway, because, well, PW does these issues about every quarter century, right? There were milestone issues in 1897 and in 1922, then 1947 and 1972, and the last one before our current one was in 1997. But just think for a second about what the last 25 years have brought to publishing. In his opening, in his intro, Michael Coffey talks about going back to the 1997 issue to sort of bone up on the history. And he says what he saw was an industry, though recognizable, of course, was truly of another era, culturally, politically, and technologically. For example, in 1997, book clubs had 20% of the market. Barnes & Noble and Follett were privatizing college bookstores. Starbucks' Howard Schultz was talking to Oprah Winfrey about selling her books along with the lattes at the Starbucks stores. The ABA was suing five publishers over price discrimination. And Bill Clinton was about to enter his second term, and Fox News was less than a year old. There wasn't even a Daily Show. Jon Stewart had yet to start the Daily Show. So things were much different. And the 125th anniversary issue in 1997 actually closed with a selection of publishing visionaries, looking ahead at the changes that digital technology might bring. And what did these visionaries envision? Well, that ebooks were not a great threat, said Grant McGuire, who was the president at the printing company R.R. Donnelly. But the World Wide Web might, you know, end up distracting people from reading. Nick Negroponte, the co-founder of the MIT Media Lab, thought that the future was going to be an electronic paper, you know, sort of a digital thing that sort of looks and feels like paper, but was actually a very fine and transparent constructive grid. And what every one of these visionaries missed, Michael Coffey pointed out, was the initial public offering of a little company known as Amazon, Amazon.com, which launched its IPO on May 15th, 1997, and has since really gone on to sort of transform the business. Now, in comparison, the force that has hit the industry over the last 25 years has been seismic, right? It's affected what books look like and how they are read or listened to, how they're purchased, where they're purchased, how they're priced, who writes them and distributes them and prints them and promotes them. There's been consolidation, the birth of social media, big tech. U.S. printing is certainly not the same as it was 25 years ago. And the roster of book distributors has been totally transformed. Indie booksellers had their ups and downs, and the chains have also suffered losses, and they've sort of readjusted. Now you can read a book on your phone or a tablet, not on electronic paper. And, you know, I kind of had a front seat to it all, not only as a reporter. You know, I wrote my first freelance article for Publishers Weekly back in 2000. It was about the threats and opportunities posed by Napster, but also as a publisher myself. You know, my first job right out of college was an editorial assistant at Dutton NAL, which had just been subsumed by Penguin. I made the princely sum of $14,000 a year to start. But I have to say, I was a lucky one. My boss, her name was Michaela Hamilton. She's now at Kensington. And not only was Michaela a vice president and a genius publisher, she was a generous and patient teacher. You know, when I started out in 1989, I didn't have a computer on my desk, only a typewriter and some very unwieldy carbon paper. And I have to say, I went through so much whiteout that when I dropped one of my documents, I thought it might shatter. But Michaela had faith in me. She invested in me. She taught me. And that's something I understand that a lot of editorial assistants today are not quite so lucky to have. I came into publishing in 1989. It was right at the tail end of the fatwa against Salman Rushdie. And I sat right down the hall from the great Peter Mayer when he was not in London or at the Viking offices. We had yet to be moved under one roof. Viking offices were back on 23rd Street back then here in New York. And even then in 1989, I remember still seeing how the changes were coming fast and furious. And I'll give you an example, word processors, you know, home computers and word processors were just sort of taking off. And over the course of my tenure as an editorial assistant, I watched as the length of unsolicited manuscripts, no longer bound by typewriters and having to being weeded out by the machinery and having to change ribbons, I watched the length of unsolicited manuscripts just explode. And with services like Federal Express getting popular, I found myself getting up to sign many, many times a day for a manuscript that was, you know, two boxes big that just absolutely positively had to get to me overnight and which ended up going on the slush pile. Anyway, from there, I went to Oxford University Press, where I had the honor of working as an associate editor to the legendary Sheldon Meyer. And that was a dream job. And I got that job thanks to my friend Karen Walney, who is moving out to greener pastures. I had a brief stint with Judith Regan at HarperCollins. And then I began writing about the industry. And I have to say, it has been a much, much easier gig getting to ask the questions than being on the other side and actually having to come up with answers to them. And today, I would argue that we're actually entering another era. You know, whether I'll be here in 25 years for the next anniversary issue of PW, questionable, right? But I'll be very interested in seeing how the publishing industry addresses the challenges that we now see as first and foremost challenges today. And that's especially at the top of the list, diversity, equity, and inclusion issues, both in terms of what is published and who is doing the publishing. I'd say that's chief among the issues we're facing now, and issues of free speech in this increasingly tech-driven communication world. But what I am certain of is that in 25 years, we're still going to be talking about books. And books will still be as vital as ever. And, you know, my personal hope is that with this 150th issue is that it offers a little perspective, right? You can look at the history of publishing. For veterans in the industry, you can look back and see that, you know, change happens. And so maybe they'll find some clues there as to what changes you might embrace and what changes you might resist. And for those just getting started in the industry, like I did back in 1989, I hope this issue will show you what needs to be changed and that, yes, you can bring change to this industry. You can and must be that change. And I really do hope that a young assistant at a publisher somewhere who's feeling who's underpaid and feeling overworked and a little stressed out might look at this issue with all the challenges and frustrations they may feel and decide to push for those changes and to envision themselves in this very issue, an anniversary issue, 25 years from now. And again, whether I'm part of that issue at age 80 is doubtful, but I definitely hope I'm going to be here to read it and to marvel at how much the industry has changed for the better.
In Kentucky, a new law gives elected judges powers over local libraries, and that has library supporters on edge.
Yeah, and this bill really stands out. And that's saying something, given the climate that we're in now, where book bans and these educational gag orders and legislation like Florida's Don't Say Gay bill have really taken the culture war up a notch. So I'm still reporting this story out because we're not exactly sure how this all happened. And I still yet to hear from the Kentucky Library Association. But here's what we know so far, thanks to some really good local reporting in the Lexington Herald Leader. The bill, which is known as Senate Bill 167, basically grants local politicians and specifically elected judges broad new powers over the roughly 120 or so library districts in the state, powers that range from being able to remove and appoint library board members to even blocking major library capital expenditures and even deciding how the buildings themselves are going to be used. Now, a few notable things here. This bill literally came back from the dead. It appeared to be all but killed after Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear vetoed it. But the Kentucky House of Representatives, after falling short of the necessary votes to override, conducted this surprise maneuver and brought the bill back. They revived it for another override vote. And then the second time, a handful of representatives who had not voted in the previous effort stepped up, voted to override Bashir's veto, narrowly carrying the measure into law. That law is now scheduled to take effect in January of 2023. Now, according to the Lexington Herald Leader, Kentucky Republicans say the issue is, and I'll quote them here, accountability. And they point out that most of Kentucky's public library boards can actually levy taxes, and therefore, you know, they should answer to someone who's actually elected by voters. But critics say the bill is, in fact, a thinly veiled effort to, quote, politicize library boards, and it does, in fact, give unprecedented control over library operations to these partisan politicians. According to the Herald Leader piece, library directors in the state are very concerned that vesting power in a single partisan political leader is going to lead to partisan-skewed boards with ideological interests in materials on library shelves, as well as programming, services, and how library buildings are used. And of course, that's all true. There's simply no question that that's true. As one library director told the Herald Leader, whenever you have political control, it's going to benefit that politician and their backers. It's not going to be for the benefit of the population or not the entire population. So much more to come on this law, but the library supporters I've spoken to have called this bill the worst story of the year so far. And again, that's really saying something given what we've seen so far in 2022. And they noted that the impact of this bill in Kentucky is going to reverberate and it's going to bleed into other states and probably fairly quickly. And we know that's probably right too, because so much of these legislative efforts that we see today are in fact drafted from model legislation meant to be easily copied in state houses. So stay tuned for more. And when I mentioned before that, you know, there are some changes that must be resisted, this is kind of what I meant.
Next Monday, the Texas Library Association holds its annual conference. In a pre-show feature for PW, you report that book bans are on the move in Texas, and they will be a hot topic at the meeting.
Yeah, after two straight years of virtual conferences during the COVID-19 pandemic, the Texas Library Association is back in person this year. It's going to run April 25th to 28th at the Fort Worth Convention Center, Fort Worth, Texas. And TLA organizers say they are energized by the prospect of Texas librarians coming together again under a conference theme of recover, rebalance, and reconnect. And it's just in time. These librarians really do need to recover, rebalance, reconnect. And though we're talking about a state library conference, make no mistake, this show is a big deal. The TLA conference is the nation's largest state library association by a Texas mile. It's very much like a national show. Before the pandemic, the TLA conference would regularly draw more than 7,000 librarians and publishers and vendors. You know, up to 500 exhibiting companies every year would come to the TLA conference. Now, no one is expecting those numbers in the first year back here in 2022. But still, some solid numbers are expected. And yeah, as you say, there are critical issues facing librarians in Texas, book banning among them. Our listeners may recall that in October of 2021, a state legislator named Matt Krause launched an investigation into some 850 books that he singled out for scrutiny in Texas schools, virtually all of them involving race or the LGBTQ community. Not to be outdone, Texas Governor Greg Abbott went on to allege that some of these schools were downright providing pornography to kids and demanded that the state agencies overseeing education and library funding be forced to take action to keep allegedly inappropriate books out of Texas schools. And Abbott has since followed up by proposing a sort of parental bill of rights that would allow for the prosecution of any educator or librarian found to have supplied a minor with material deemed inappropriate, as well as stripping that person of their professional credentials and placing them on a do not hire list. In addition, you know, the state is still wrestling with COVID-19, let's be honest, which, you know, many of us want to believe that we're past COVID, but it's still a threat. And TLA officials say librarians are committed to having a safe show in Texas. And they're also committed to standing up to these book bans and other efforts in the state. I talked to the TLA president, Daniel Burgard, who sounded almost in disbelief when we spoke about the situation in Texas and across the nation. He told me that the idea that someone would use librarians and teachers as ammunition in their political campaigns, in their political battles, and that they would willfully, purposefully seek to destroy the faith and trust people hold in public education and in public libraries, to him, and I'll quote him here, he said it's just shocking. And he says that while librarians have a, and again, I'll quote him, a dogged belief that librarians and free speech will eventually come out on top, it's going to be ugly for a while. And he said that you just have to hope that when it's all done, librarians and educators haven't lost a huge amount of trust and political goodwill in the process. Now, you can read all about the TLA conference on the PW site. And again, these threats that are facing libraries and schools and authors and, of course, publishers, these are all top of mind. And again, I'll say, you know, when I talked about the changes that should be resisted, well, these book banning efforts are top of the list of those efforts.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks for joining me on the program.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on the next podcast from CCC, in the scholarly publishing world, spring brings the annual return of STM Trends, a future-forward look at the entire ecosystem from members of the STM Association. Each year, STM Trends fixes the latest innovations in research and publishing in a single image. This year's shows a field of sunflowers on a bright summer's day. Farmers, bees, butterflies, and birds are all busy going about their businesses. Afke Schmidt, STM's Director of Standards and Technology, decodes the scene and tells me why there are scarecrows, too.
In fact, a key problem with open access information is that we require a new locus of trust. If there are so many platforms around and if there's so much information in many different versions available on all these platforms, then we need to know which information can be trusted or cannot be trusted. The scarecrows actually warn us against fake information, fake science, misinformation.
Latest STM Trends launches coming on the next CCC podcast. Our producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening to this Velocity of Content podcast from CCC.